These men, along with Fate magazine and Ray Palmer, has been making every effort to awaken the public to the awesome fact that our world might well be under observation by beings from another planet. But now several unknown men were speaking up and declaring that they had actually had contact with the sources and space visitors. Among those were George Van Tassel, Truman Bitherham, George Adamski, George Williamson and Alfred Bailey. Those few newspapers which ran stories on these men did so with the tongue-in-cheek slant. Sunday afternoons I was speaking to groups at the Hollywood Hotel. I knew that my audience waited patiently for clear, concise accounts of my experiences with extraterrestrials. But they were often disappointed. Frequently when I stepped upon the platform to speak, a strange transition came over me. It was as though another personality overshadowed me, someone who knew all the answers. But the answers were not in my familiar English or Italian, but in an unfamiliar, half-remembered tongue. I would struggle to translate the ideas into English and end up by failing to be clear and direct. Thus, with the understanding of the universe almost within my grasp, I was often helpless to reveal any part of it. Nevertheless, even with my many failures to be concise and direct, the meetings gained momentum with increasing numbers in the audience. It was then that Max Miller conceived the idea of a flying saucer convention. It sounded like a tremendous idea to me. With the help of several other persons, we enthusiastically began to formulate plans. It was decided that we should hold the convention at the Hollywood Hotel, where there was plenty of room in the lobby to accommodate a large audience. Various exhibits of saucer photographs, spaceship models, books, magazines and pamphlets on the saucers were set up around the lobby, and many circulars were mailed out announcing the event. Also, invitations to speak at the convention were mailed to all persons who had been most helpful in revealing and disseminating information about the saucers and extraterrestrials. But response to the invitations was very poor. Less than a week before the convention was to open, it appeared that none of the speakers that we had counted upon would be present. Max was greatly worried. "It looks like we're sunk, Orfeo," he exclaimed dejectedly. "This thing is going to be the prize flop of any and all conventions." But as I looked at him, the conviction was suddenly strongly in my mind that everything would come off well. I replied, "Don't worry, Max. It's going to come off much better than we ever dreamed it would." My prediction proved entirely correct. Every one of the speakers whom we had invited showed up for the convention, and some others besides. Among the invited speakers were Frank Scully, Arthur Luis Jokelto, George Van Tassel, George Adamski, Truman Bitherham, John Otto from Chicago, Harding Walsh and a mysterious Dr. X who spoke long and eloquently on the saucers. He left immediately after speaking, and no one ever knew who he really was or where he came from, although many inquired, for he had some startling things to say. Almost to a man, the speakers said they had received an irresistible urge to attend on Friday, 2 days before the opening of the convention. Could it be that the space visitors had been at work in their subtle way? At any rate, the convention was a tremendous success. For 3 days and nights the crowds overflowed the Hollywood Hotel out onto the lawns and adjacent Hollywood Boulevard. In fact, the response was so tremendous that on the second morning I requested Max to stop all publicity on the convention. Some of the larger Los Angeles newspapers covered the convention. But all news stories were of the tongue-in-cheek type. A few of the smaller, more rabid papers tried to expose it as nothing but a promotional money-making scheme. The convention was a hectic one. I was busy night and day and carried on practically without sleep. When I wasn't speaking, people were surrounding me and bombarding me with endless questions. Many were speaking at the weekly meetings and the three nerve-wracking days of the convention. I never once lost my temper. A power beyond my own consciousness or control carried me through. In trying moments of heckling or confusion, an upsurgence of peace and calm would pick me up and give me strength equal to the occasion. However, on the last night of the convention, the power that was sustaining me suddenly failed and I lost my temper for the first time. alone women who had been especially persistent in seeking me out and cornering me to revile me and hurl quotes of scripture at me was responsible for the outburst. She knew I was wrong and she was right. And she had books, diagrams and Bible verses to prove it. When at last I literally blew my top, she joyfully picked up her data and departed, shouting that my temper proved I was an agent of the devil. Within an hour I lost my temper several times again. The most trying experience of the convention occurred when a large group of materialists were literally giving me the works in a stubborn, derisive effort to get to the bottom of my story and ferret out obvious flaws from a common sense viewpoint. Sincere, open-minded, honest persons who are willing to investigate the event of space visitors never resort to such sneering interrogations. They ask honest, sincere questions on points they fully do not understand. But they have an honest desire to know, not to discredit, to sneer and to disparage. This particular group had their minds set upon exposing me. Their methods, although entirely on a mental plane, would make the medieval inquisitions seem innocuous. Like little demons, they parroted elementary physics and could see practical, intelligent action only behind the Iron Curtain. They knew that I was a cheap publicity seeker who did not hesitate to lie about space visitors or anything else to further my own ends. No words of explanation could possibly prove anything to them they did not wish to believe. I had undergone just as bitter and insinuating criticism before. But I was exceptionally tired that last night. I felt almost though I were melting away before venomous onslaught, collapsing at the seams, as it were, and suddenly I felt very, very human and down to earth. I was on the verge of exploding in anger again when a kind of veil was drawn over my conscious mind. The gesticulating figures before me faded to babbling, inconsequential shadows. As they continued their violent attacks, my thoughts drifted calmly back to a scene of a few weeks before. I was attending a convention of science fiction writers at the Hotel Commodore in Los Angeles. Since my experiences with the extraterrestrials, I have become interested in the field of science fiction, for I have found that many scientific truths are adumbrated, or delineated, in science fiction before ever they become realities of our own world. Many well-known writers in the science fiction field were present. When I came in, they were holding open discussions of trends in the science fiction, the various new markets, etc. One of the audience asked, "Why have all science fiction writers suddenly stopped writing or even mentioning flying saucers?" A speaker replied authoritatively that the subject had become taboo with them. Another member of the audience demanded to know why this was so, since the saucers had actually given such an impetus to the science fiction field. The speaker had no adequate answer for that one, but lamely explained that the saucers were old stuff now. I was becoming impatient with the proceedings and was on the point of leaving when the guest speaker of the evening was announced. He was Mr. Gerald Hurd, the well-known science fiction writer and author of Is Another World Watching? Mr. Hurd spoke with great eloquence and a deep, penetrating philosophy. He berated the writers for turning out material of an inferior grade and warned that the public would not continue to stomach it, much less to buy it. Many of them squirmed uncomfortably in their seats. As he neared the end of his stimulating and thought-provoking talk, his eyes met mine where I was seated near the back with two companions. I noticed that he seemed tired and shaken. As our eyes met and held, a kind of mutual understanding passed between us in ever-widening circles. Dimly, I could hear him terminating his speech with these words, "There is one in this room tonight I do not know he is, but he's going to upset the whole apple cart." He paused, then his voice reverberated as he added, "He is the awakener. He has not yet appeared, but he well may be here in this room tonight. Thank you." And the mystic wheels between us, set in motion by the controlled magnetic vortices, slowly receded and vanished. I looked about the room at the audience, but they were no longer listening to him. Some were whispering and laughing among themselves. As I looked about that busy room, I thought that it was small wonder that the concoctors of science fiction horror diets had declared the saucers taboo. Far too much beautiful reality was on the side of the saucers. Harmony and beauty are much too tame for the horror boys. They have joined forces with the materialists, subversives and egotists to fight the flying saucer sensationalists down at every turn. But the joke is on them, for reality slipped quietly past them and established new frontiers of its own. The science fictioners were induced by subtle forces to ignore flying saucers, as were many other materialistic sources of information. During the welcome lull, the actual flying saucer phenomena and the extraterrestrials were left to the inexperienced but honest handling of rank amateurs. At first these men were inept and inarticulate, but they are finding their voices and their numbers rapidly increasing. The space visitors had actually only cleared the atmosphere for them. Had the professional spinners of horror fiction stuck to the theme of flying saucers, the true contacts could never have been able to perform their missions. Chapter 8: My Awakening on Another Planet. It was in the late summer of 1953 that the most beautiful and revealing of all of my experiences with the etheric beings developed. My life had been a kaleidoscope of new understandings and changing patterns since the night of my trip in the saucer. But apparently the most profound of all had to be revealed to my conscious mind in gradual steps of understanding, because the experience itself actually occurred in January of 1953 while I was still on the job at Lockheed, but it was not until 6 months later that I had any idea of the tremendous experience that had been mine. During those bewildering intervening 6 months, I honestly believed that for 7 days of my life in January 1953 I had been a victim of complete amnesia. I told no one about it, not even Mabel, for so many confounding things had happened in the recent months of my life that I feared further complicating matters by relating an experience for which there seemed to be no explanation. During those 6 months I experienced many very strange and disquieting hours. Vivid dreams of a hauntingly beautiful, half-familiar world troubled my sleep. Sometimes I would awaken trembling and bathed in perspiration, feeling that I was close to conscious remembrance of an exquisitely beautiful experience that would explain many things. Also, frequently during the days, fleeting, tenuous memories drifted into the borderland of my consciousness. Even more perplexing were those occasions when, while speaking to groups of persons at the Hollywood Hotel, I felt as though I were being somehow overshadowed by another greater personality, a personality who thought neither in my familiar English or Italian, but in a strange language which it seemed I once knew but now could no longer remember. In order to clarify the experience itself, I must go back to that day in January 1953 when it began. I did not go to work that afternoon as I was just recovering from the flu. But I was feeling so much better that I believed I could go back on the job the following day. Mabel was at work at the cafe and I was alone. About 4 o'clock a rather strange, detached feeling came over me. I was aware of a familiar odd prickling sensation in my arms and the back of my neck which usually announced the proximity of spacecraft. I discounted the strange symptoms thinking they were only the result of my illness. Then suddenly I began to feel so drowsy that I could scarcely keep my eyes open. I remember starting toward the divan to lie down for a nap, but I later had absolutely no recollection of reaching the divan. My next conscious perception was a peculiar awakening or regaining consciousness while on my job in the plastics department at Lockheed. Stupefied and bewildered, I looked uncertainly about the factory. Dazedly, I recognized the familiar faces of my co-workers and noticed the tools in my hands. I caught my breath sharply and an icy shiver quivered over my entire body as quite involuntarily I recoiled with a shudder from the entire scene. I didn't know why then, but everything seemed hopelessly wrong, primitive and crude. In a daze I rubbed a hand across my eyes hoping to eradicate the scene. Then I was seized with a blinding vertigo and thought I was going to lose consciousness. Dave Donegan, my working partners, looked at me sympathetically, and there was genuine concern in his eyes. He didn't say anything, but quietly took the tools from my hand and in his quiet, understanding way went ahead, carrying on alone. An involuntary outburst of utter disgust came from my lips, disgust with everything I saw. It seemed like the Dark Ages. I remember hearing Dave say, "Are you all right, boy?" I didn't reply, I couldn't. In panic I turned to rush out of the door. In my bland haste I bumped roughly into Richard Butterfield, the temporary lead man in my section. I must have looked acutely ill because I vaguely remember seeing the alarm in his eyes as he grasped me firmly but gently by the shoulders and exclaimed, "Angie! Angie! What's wrong with you?" I was breathing hard. Both emotionally and mentally I was confused and uncertain. My thoughts were in turmoil. I had only one objective, to get out of that place. But the presence of Butterfield had a stabilizing, quieting effect upon me. He smiled reassuringly while keeping his hands upon my shoulders. "Calm down, Angie, old boy," he said gently. "Go upstairs and take a break. You look beat." I mumbled my heartfelt thanks and stumbled up the steps, not yet aware of what actually had happened to me. I got a cup of coffee. Never before had I needed one so badly. My hands were shaking and every nerve in my body was quivering. As I drank the hot, aromatic stuff, I tried to think back, to remember why I was so shaken and upset. But my last recollection before my strange, perturbed awakening on the job, was walking toward the divan in my apartment. The intervening period was a total blank. Noticing a copy of the Los Angeles Times on one of the tables, I nervously picked it up and glanced at the date. Perspiration broke out on my forehead. The date of the paper was January 19, 1953. 7 days had elapsed of which I had absolutely no recollection. But even the date on the paper couldn't convince me. Trying to keep my voice casual, I asked a worker at a nearby table. He confirmed the date on the newspaper. My body was bathed in cold perspiration. I was on the edge of panic as I sat there, my hands trembling so that I could hardly take a sip of coffee. I couldn't believe that 7 days and nights had passed, leaving not a trace of memory in my mind. Later in the afternoon, when I was feeling a little better, I went back downstairs on the job. But it was a real effort to behave in a normal, rational manner with my thoughts in turmoil. Cautiously and discreetly I questioned Dave and other fellow workers about those 7 previous days. From their replies I gathered that I had been on the job every day and had apparently behaved in my usual manner until my strange awakening and violent outburst that afternoon. At home I didn't mention my inexplicable loss of memory to Mabel. And apparently she had noticed nothing unusual in my behavior during that entire week. It seemed that in every way I had behaved in my accustomed manner. I had eaten my meals, slept, gone to and from work and helped Mabel out at the snack bar, as usual. It was fantastically incredible. I told no one what had happened to me. But in my own mind I was utterly baffled and deeply troubled about those 7 lost days out of my life. Imagine yourself in my place. Suppose that for an entire week your waking consciousness had been obliterated so that you could not remember a single event. Wouldn't you be deeply disturbed? Wouldn't you begin to wonder if you might not be psychopathic? In all sincerity, I can tell that you would, for those were my own panic-stricken thoughts. But as the days passed, I gradually settled down into the routine of daily life. Often I tried hard to regain the memory of those 7 lost days. But it seemed hopeless. Months passed and I had about decided that for those 7 days I had suffered from complete loss of memory. Except for the disquieting thoughts and vivid dreams, I had no intimation of what was coming until that memorable night in the first week in September, 1953. I was feeling unusually restless that evening. Shortly after 10 o'clock I went out for a walk. As always, my feet seemed involuntarily to carry me toward the Hyperion Avenue freeway bridge. In its dark, mysterious shadows I always found a kind of spiritual peace and comfort, for it was there I had met and talked with Neptune, the man from another world. I was thinking of these things as I clambered down the concrete embankment into the almost dry bed of the Los Angeles River. Walking over to the spot where Neptune had talked with me, I sat down disconsolately upon the ground. I rested my head upon the stone where he had sat, and gazed thoughtfully up into the heavens and thought of the spiraling, endless wonders of the universe. Lost in reverie, A feeling of deep inner peace and tranquility came over me. Noisy, clattering earth with all of its troubles, dissensions and animosities seemed remote and relatively unimportant. As my thoughts drifted pleasantly, I felt again the odd sensation which was always my first awareness of space visitors. But I was deeply puzzled, for Neptune had last told me, "We will return, Orpheo, but not to you." Nevertheless, the odd tingling in my arms and back of my neck was unmistakable. Hopefully, my eyes scanned the heavens. I saw nothing that in any way resembled a saucer. The intensity of the vibration increased, dimming the awareness of my conscious mind much as it had the night I had first encountered the saucer. As in a dream, my thoughts drifted back to that mysterious Monday afternoon 6 months before when, feeling much as I did now, I had walked toward the divan to take a nap. An astonishing thing was happening. I was beginning to remember, faintly, hazily, at first, like the sun's golden rays breaking through black clouds. As memory flooded back, I clearly recalled again that Monday afternoon. I was walking towards the divan. My eyes were so heavy I could scarcely keep them open. In a daze I sank down upon the divan and immediately fell into a deep sleep. Only now I could remember waking from that sleep. My awakening was in a strange and wonderful world. I was no longer upon earth. Some fantastic transition had taken place. I awoke in a huge, fabulously beautiful room, a room the substance of which glowed ethereally with soft, exquisite colors. I was lying upon a luxurious couch, or lounge. Half awake, I glanced down at my body, but it was not familiar. My body was never so perfectly proportioned or of so fine coloring and texture. I noticed that I was wearing only a fine white garment, closely fitted and covering my chest, torso and upper part of my thighs. A finely wrought gold belt was about my waist. Although the belt appeared to be made of heavy links of embossed gold, it was without weight. My new body felt amazingly light and ethereal and vibrant with life. Full consciousness did not come to me at once. My first thoughts upon waking in that shining world were nebulous. Somehow the thought persisted in my mind that I was recovering from a long and serious illness. Thus I reclined there in a kind of pleasant lethargy as one does who has been very ill. Random thoughts drifted in my consciousness. Everything was so new and different, and yet it was hauntingly familiar. My handsome new body was not my body, and yet it was. The exquisite room with its ethereal, softly glowing colors was like nothing ever dreamed of upon earth, and yet somehow it was not strange and alien to me. Only one thing seemed unfamiliar. Far away outside the huge, windowless room I could hear the continuous rumble of distant thunder. Oddly enough, the thunder did not fill me with apprehension as had always been the case in the past. Gradually the dark mists began clearing from my mind. Incredible memories were coming back to me, memories of another world, a different people, another life. Lost horizons, deep buried memories, forgotten vistas were surfacing to my consciousness. I remember this world. I thought rapturously. I remember it in the same way that a condemned prisoner remembers the sunshine, the trees, the flowers of the outside world after an eternity chained in a dark and odious prison. This is my real world, my true body. I have been lost in a dimension called time and a captive in a forbidding land called earth. But now, somehow, I have come home. All is serenity, peace, harmony and indescribable beauty here. The only disturbing factor is a troublesome half-memory of an unhappy shadow named Orpheo, a bondsman in a prison world of materiality called Earth. As the disturbing thoughts of this lost Orpheo troubled me, a portion of one wall noiselessly divided, making an imposing doorway, and a woman entered. She was dazzlingly beautiful. Somehow my mind understood that she was the one in whose charge I was placed, even as I also understood that the mysterious door opened and closed automatically by means of electromagnetic controls. She looked down at me and smiled warmly. Her beauty was breathtaking. She was dressed simply in a kind of Grecian gown of glowing silvery white substance. Her hair was golden and fell in soft waves about her shoulders. Her eyes were extremely large, expressive and deep blue. Soft shimmering colors played continuously about her, apparently varying with every slight change of her thought or mood. Hauntingly, the thought was in my mind that I remembered her from somewhere. She seemed to sense my perplexity and reassuringly said that I was looking very well and would soon be up and about. Then she touched a control on a crystal cabinet near my bed. In response, a large section of the opposite wall opened, revealing a huge mirror. I looked into its crystal depths, but the man I saw was not Orfeo, nor yet was he a stranger to me. Paradoxically, I remembered and yet I didn't remember. "I have gained weight," I remarked, not knowing just why I made such a statement, then added, "Also, I feel much better now." She smiled and replied, "On the contrary, you have lost weight. According to all earthly standards, you are now almost weightless." Her strange words puzzled me. I glanced down at my body, which appeared to be solidly substantial in addition to being much larger and more finely proportioned. "It's all a matter of the scale of vibration in which you are functioning," she explained. "The vibratory rate of dense matter which makes up the planet Earth is extremely low, hence earthly bodies are sluggish, dense and cumbersome. Vibratory rates here are quite high and matter so tenuous that it would seem non-existent were you in a dense physical body. Because you are now in a body of a corresponding vibratory rate, the phenomena of this world is as real to you as your Earth world." As I listened to her speak, I thought I remembered her name. "You are Lyra?" I said half questioningly. She nodded her head. I was about to ask her about herself when I was conscious again of the continuous, low rumble of thunder from outside. I became curious to go out of doors and look around. Turning to Lyra, I asked, "May I go outside now?" She shook her head. "You are not yet strong enough, but I promise that before the seventh day you shall see all, Neptune." Her words startled me. Why had she called me Neptune? I wondered. I was not Neptune, neither was Neptune ill. And what did she mean by the seventh day? I was about to ask her these questions when she turned and looked expectantly toward the far wall. In a moment the mysterious door appeared and a tall, strikingly handsome man entered. It was Orion. In some confused way I recognized him at once and felt a surge of affection for him in my heart. As with Lyra, shimmering waves of translucent color played about him, seemingly reflecting his thoughts. He smiled warmly and said, "We have missed you, Neptune." I brushed my hand across my eyes in a dazed way as I replied, "But I am not Neptune, there is some mistake." "Are you certain?" he asked gently. "You will recall that Neptune was the name you gave to our brother who first contacted you upon Earth. That name has always held a strange, deep significance for you, perhaps because it was once your own name." As he spoke, the odd realization possessed me that he was indeed speaking the truth. In their world, I was, or had once been, Neptune. "But the other Neptune?" I asked. "Who, then, is he?" Orion glanced at Lyra and a scintillating wave of golden light enfolded them both. Orion replied slowly, "With us names are of little significance. The brother of whom you speak was in the illusion of the past known as Astra, but in the higher octaves of light, individualized aspects such as you know upon Earth are non-existent. Even now as we manifest in this most tenuous of material states of being, you are not aware of us in our true eternal aspect. We are, you might say in terms of Earth, staging a dress show reception for you, our lost brother. Before the destruction our existence was much as you see it now, that is why you seem to remember all of this. In that phase of the time dimension you were known as Neptune. Something was wrong, terribly wrong, somewhere. I thought. If only I could remember clearly. But everything was so confused. As I gazed at those two superbly magnificent beings standing side by side enveloped in shimmering waves of golden light, I felt intuitively that I had known them well, sometime, somewhere. I had known them on an equal level, I had been one of them. But now they were like gods to me, and I a straggler, somehow far, far behind them. My mind deluded by a loathsome illness. I pressed my hands to my eyes, trying with all of my strength to remember something important, and terrible, that I had forgotten. Neither of them spoke. Lyra took a white wafer from the crystal cabinet while Orion poured a sparkling liquid into a lavender crystal goblet. These they handed to me. I ate the delicately flavored wafer and drank the delicious beverage. I felt renewed vitality and strength flow through my body and with it a dreamy languor of mind. Lyra and Orion smiled upon me and the scintillating waves of golden light reached out from them and enfolded me in a warm comforting glow. Sleep for a while, Neptune, Lyra murmured softly. Then the mysterious door appeared and they left arm in arm, leaving me alone. The light in the room dimmed and waves of soft, exquisite music flowed from the walls. I fell into a deep, dreamless sleep. When I awoke, light was streaming brilliantly into the room. One entire wall had miraculously vanished, revealing an outer balcony. I sat up and looked out beyond the balcony upon an incredibly wonderful and fantastic world. It was radiant with light, and yet there appeared to be a heavy moving cloud bank overhead. Continuous sheet lightning flashed through the rainbow-hued clouds, and the constant rumble of distant thunder was slightly louder. Also, I saw brilliant slow-moving fireballs, blades, varied colored flares and showers of brilliant sparks. I was deeply puzzled, for all of this phenomena did not seem at all familiar, as had so many other things in this world. I jumped up from the couch and ran out onto the broad balcony, marveling at the wonderful feeling of lightness and vibrant strength in my body. What a glorious world I looked upon! A dream world, beyond the wildest flight of imagination. Ethereal, scintillating color everywhere. Fantastically beautiful buildings constructed of a kind of crystal plastic substance that quivered with continuously changing color hues. As I watched, windows, doors, balconies and stairs appeared and just as miraculously disappeared in the shining facades of the buildings. The grass, trees and flowers sparkled with living colors that seemed almost to glow with a light of their own. I caught my breath in awe. And yet, somehow, it was familiar. A world I had once known, and forgotten. A few statuesque and a majestically beautiful people were walking in the pedestrian lanes. No vehicles of any type were visible. Then I saw Lyra and Orion conversing with each other near a large circular flower garden, almost directly below me. They both looked up and smiled, calling out a friendly greeting. I ran down and joined them, exclaiming, "What a magnificent world! Do you remember it, Neptune?" Lyra asked gently. I hesitated, then replied, "Much is familiar, but other things are not. I can't recall the lightning and the constant thunder. And the horizon appears to be only about a mile distant, and it should be, I seem to remember it was almost limitless." For a moment there was deep silence. Lyra glanced questioningly at Orion, and a look of deep pain crossed their faces as the golden waves of iridescent light about them changed to misty purple. I realized immediately I had said the wrong thing. Lyra touched a crystal she held in her hand, and the sound of the thunder was muffled until it was barely audible.